Appreciate it. Can everybody hear me okay? The volume good? All right, excellent. Thank you for coming out late on an evening to hear about genetics. Hopefully, you will find the evening informative. There's some really exciting things going on in terms of genetics in Angus cattle today, and so there's a whole kind of array of things that I want to discuss with you tonight. For starters, I'm not sure maybe if everybody's familiar with what Angus Genetics Incorporated does, along with CAB and API. We are one of the subsidiaries of the American Angus Association, and it's our mission to provide genetic selection tools for the beef industry. So that means for you all in this room and for your customers as well. And so along those lines, here's sort of a roadmap where I want to take you tonight. We are in an exciting time in terms of genomic technology and the things we can do with knowing about an animal's DNA. So I'm going to spend the first couple of minutes and take you back to school for just a second, okay? Bullets number one and two. We're going to review a little bit Genetics 101, and I promise that it won't take long. We'll get through that in pretty short order. Talk about this word mutation. You've probably heard the word mutation a lot in the last couple weeks, perhaps. So what is it? What does it mean? Is it important? Why is it important? And so those will be sort of the more heavy science topics that I want to talk about. And then I promise you that I will bring it back around to your cattle. And we'll talk about EPDs, do a little bit of review there and some interesting things that we learned with some EPDs this summer, how the genomics piece relates to that and to our indexes as well. I still get a lot of questions about the indexes and which ones are the appropriate ones to use in various situations. And we'll kind of round out the evening with the genomic trait tests that I'm sure you're familiar with. And so if you have some questions as we roll along here, please feel free to ask. I'm happy to address those, or I can take them at the end. And I'll be here for the entire tour, riding around, looking at the cattle with us and touring. So if you catch me on a stop and have a burning question, please feel free to ask. So with that, let's go ahead and dive off into this, okay? Chromosomes. This is what this is a picture of. This is actually called a karyotype. And a karyotype is nothing more than a picture of an animal's chromosomes. Okay, and this happens to be from cattle. I know this because there are 29 numbered chromosomes, and then we've got a pair of sex chromosomes down there. Anybody want to guess if that's a bull or a cow we're looking at? It's a bull. Yes, it is. Why do I know that? Well, because it has an X chromosome and a Y. If that was a cow, it would have two X chromosomes, okay? So cattle are what we call diploid, and this is important in understanding inheritance for some of our defects that you're familiar with. We inherit one copy of every chromosome from the female side and one from the bull side. So animals have two copies of their entire genome, and I know that in this picture it looks like they have four. That's because the only time the chromosomes are condensed enough to take a picture of them is right before they divide. And the chromosomes actually replicate before they divide. And so it looks like there's four there. So don't be scared. This is not some freak thing that happened. It was at Texas A&M. So that might say something, but no, I'm kidding. I know there's an Aggie in the audience. That was for you, Casey. During meiosis and gametogenesis, these chromosomes will go through cellular division twice, and we'll end up with one copy of every single one of those chromosomes in each cell. Okay, so all the animals have two copies of their genetic material, one inherited from the cow side, one inherited from the dam side. Where are chromosomes housed? And we hear about DNA, we hear about chromosomes, so how does all of this stuff fit together, okay? Well, I just told you about chromosomes, and it turns out that chromosomes are nothing more than really, really tightly packed DNA. In order to fit all of the DNA that holds all of our all of the DNA, it has to be compacted and wound up really, really tightly so that it'll fit here in the nucleus of every single cell. Okay? So every single cell in an animal's body has this DNA wound up really, really tightly into those 29 numbered chromosomes in the sex chromosomes, and they fit in the nucleus of the cell. All right? But DNA is actually where all the interesting stuff happens, okay? So we have to unravel those chromosomes and get down to the DNA and take a really close look at that double helix that I'm sure you're all familiar with that Watson and Crick discovered back in the 1950s, right? Really, the basis for life and the way our animals look the way they do and perform the way they do is held within these base pairs right here in the middle. There's A's, which you see here, there's T's, there's G's, and there's C's. Those four little letters combine in a multitude of different ways to make you and I look and act in the way we do and make our animals look and perform the way that they do. Four little letters, okay? And the reason for that is because DNA held within the chromosome of every single cell gets transcribed into something called RNA, which is able to leave the nucleus of the cell and go out into where all the cellular machinery is. It actually turns that into proteins. And proteins are the things that they make metabolism happen, they make growth happen, all of the things that are necessary for life to be carried out. They're the basis of pigments, even, for instance, okay? So protein really are where the DNA actually ends up, DNA to RNA to protein, okay? And that's important because I want to show you how big of a difference one little change in one of those A's, T's, G's, and C's can happen. And we'll get there in just a minute, okay? But we need to understand this first of all. Those A's, T's, G's, and C's are divided into these little three-letter words. It takes three A's, T's, G's, or C's, those nucleotides, to make one amino acid. And of course, we know that we string amino acids together and then fold them up and stack them together, and they're what make proteins, okay? So, for instance, if we're going along and we're looking at a piece of DNA, and I see an A, and I didn't mention U's, right? You see no T's up here. That's because in RNA, the stuff that we actually turn into protein, there are no T's. T is substituted with a U, okay? So if on that piece of RNA it says A, U, G, what the heck does that mean? Well, we go to our little table here, and I find an A, I find a U, and then I G. And that says that's an initiator. If anywhere in the genome it says AUG, that's an indication that a gene starts right here. A gene that's going to code for a specific protein starts right here. Okay? And then, so we start there, and then we start reading off again in those three-letter words and add all of these amino acids to it until we come up with a stop codon. And examples of those, so if we came to a UAA, that would be, this gene stops here. So that protein is ready to go now. We have all of the amino acids making up that protein, and we stop. So we read the DNA in these little three-letter words, okay? That DNA and all of those proteins are actually responsible, like I said earlier, for our animals looking the way they do, performing the way they do. And we can really divide those things into a couple of different types of traits. One is simply inherited traits, okay, and these are where maybe one or two genes are what determines why an animal looks the way they do. These traits tend to be very categorical, meaning red versus black, horned versus polled. The defects, carrier, not, would be classified in these. So they're very, very simply inherited. It's all genetic. The environment doesn't play a role here. And so that's one type of trait. The other type of trait that we're really interested in are what we call quantitative traits. I prefer to call them performance traits. That makes more sense to me, and it's more cowboy language than a quantitative trait would be. But these traits, there's a genetic component, but we know the environment can also play a very large role in why an animal performs the way they do for these traits. The reproductive traits, the weight traits, the carcass traits, those types of things are what would be called quantitative or performance traits. In addition, there can be hundreds of genes that contribute to an animal performing the way they do for the carcass traits or performing the way they do for the weight traits. All of these performance traits have potentially hundreds of genes that affect why an animal looks the way they do or performs the way they do for those traits. Okay, so simply inherited traits, quantitative traits or performance traits. They both have DNA underlying them, but they are inherited in a bit different pattern. Okay, so that's sort of going back and reminding us, what is DNA? What is chromosomes? How are they related to each other? Okay, a little refresher, and then the A's, T's, G's, and C's. And so now I want to talk about that word that I mentioned at the very beginning, mutation, which you may have heard of before. How many of you have heard the word mutation? Okay, yes, I'm sure you have. So what is a mutation? Very simple. It's just a change in the genetic material. Okay, a change in the genetic material. All right, very, very simple. It can also be the way that change occurs. So the act of the DNA changing from one form to another can be called, that's the process of mutation. Okay, so it can be both the change itself and the process by which it happens. A mutant, believe it or not, that's a real word. It's not just sci-fi. Okay, a mutant, on the other hand, is an individual that has a phenotype that was caused by a mutation. An individual that has a phenotype that was caused by a mutation. All right? So, types of mutations. A mutation can be actually found in the chromosomes. It can be changes in the number of chromosomes. You know, we've heard of in people some having an extra chromosome, right? So that would be considered a mutation, and it affects phenotype. Sometimes we'll get the end of a chromosome nicked off or something, and that would be considered a mutation, right? So all of those things. The ones that we tend to be most concerned about and talk about the most in terms of recent times in cattle are changes at a specific site in a gene. So what I mean by that are, let's take a look over here on the left, is what would be considered normal or the original. And we're trucking along with an A, T, G, A, 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 G, G, G. And over here, we start off the same, A, T, G, A, A, A. But instead of a G right here, we have a C. That's a mutation. Okay? Well, why do we care about that? Well, remember, we read in three-letter words, right? And so we would read, this would get translated into, or transcribed into this piece of RNA, and it's AUG, which we said means start. So the gene starts there. And then we have an AAA, which codes for lysine. So that's our next amino acid. And then we have a GGG, which codes for glycine. So that would be our next amino acid. Look what happens over here. We start the same with our AUG start. Lysine is still the same, but now that we changed that G to a C, we get arginine there instead. And because that was inserted, that C was inserted right there, it throws everything off all the way down the line because we have an extra base pair in there now. So now everything from there on out is different. We're not even making the same protein anymore, are we? Amino acids are completely different. So that's an example of a mutation. Additions of nucleotides like we see there, sometimes one will get subtracted. That'll throw it off just the same because we're not reading the three letters in the same order anymore, right? Sometimes maybe one of them just changes to another. We'll get an A changing to a C or a G changing to a T. That will happen occasionally too. And those aren't quite as bad or as devastating typically as when we delete things or add things in. All right? So what happens? If you have a mutation, what happens? And the answer is, well, it varies and it depends. Sometimes nothing really happens. Maybe the mutation occurs in part of the DNA that doesn't really code for anything. So you may not see anything happen. Maybe it's a mutation that occurs and you still get the same amino acid sequence, because that can happen. So you wouldn't really see an effect. And then some mutations, of course, can be lethal. All right, and we are aware of that. Now, here is the thing that some of you may not be aware of. We are all carriers of something. We all have mutations. All of your cattle have mutations. In fact, every single one of us sitting in the room and every single one of the animals running around on your ranches and farms is a carrier of at least 5 lethal mutations. Okay? The good news is most of them are recessive, and so they would have had to inherit one from both parents in order to ever see it. And most of our animals, the gene frequency never gets high enough to do that. It's just one little animal running around with this mutation, and maybe they never get to become a parent at all. Maybe they don't have that many calves, and so we just don't see that mutation spread widely within the breed. Now, what happens when a very, very popular animal has a lethal mutation is you do then see that mutation getting spread from to its progeny and to their progeny. And it's only then that you ever see, that you ever see the result of these mutations, because then we have a chance for animals to inherit one from each parent. And that's when the recessive abnormalities occur. Okay? So, moral of the story, mutations are out there. And they happen. And so the good news is, and we'll talk about this in just a minute, that we have some tools that allow us to manage those much better than we've been able to in the past. So I've talked about mutation and maybe scared the living daylights out of you right now. Okay, I'm seeing some shocked faces out there. So how many of you think mutation is a bad thing, that we should just, you want to get rid of it? Let's get rid of mutation, make it go away. How many of you want that to happen? Oh, hallelujah, you didn't say that, okay? Mutation is very, very important, okay? It is the only way that we have to get new and novel genetic material, okay? We have black cattle and red cattle because there was a mutation that caused that to happen. We have horned cattle and polled cattle because there was a mutation that caused that to happen. Okay, we have Bos Indicus versus Bos Taurus and all of the other breeds because of mutations that have built up over the centuries that allow those breeds to be different, those species to be different, and our individual animals to be different. So mutation is a necessary and vital thing in order for species to be able to thrive and survive over generations and centuries and millennia. It's very important, okay? It just causes us some headaches every now and then, doesn't it? Okay. Does that make sense? All right. So I promised I would bring it back around to cattle, and I will do that now. That's enough of the science part, okay? So I hope you can appreciate that DNA and genomics does relate to cattle. It causes our black Angus cattle to be black, and it causes our black Angus cattle to be polled on the simply inherited trait side. It causes some of our animals to be outstanding from a marbling standpoint, from a growth standpoint. It causes some to be more maternally oriented. It all goes back down to the DNA and to a genetic basis. Okay? From a strictly molecular standpoint and looking at DNA, it's also caused us to have some genetic selection tools, some really powerful genetic selection tools. We do have tests at our disposal today that will tell us if an animal is a carrier for a genetic defect or not. And then management strategies can be employed on what to do with those animals otherwise. Okay? This was not the case necessarily in the past. There have been genetic defects in the past. There may be some of you that remember the big dwarfism problem that occurred several decades ago in this country. They didn't have DNA selection and weren't able to find the carriers. So we probably lost a lot of really good animals that had some really, really great genetics for traits that were important. But because they were potential carriers for a defect, they were eliminated from the population. Okay, just because an animal is a carrier of a defect doesn't mean they don't have something else to offer. And so we're lucky that we have those tests available to us today. In addition, you all are familiar with EPDs, and I'll talk a little bit about those. But we also have at our disposal genomic tests for those traits that tell us something about an animal's genetic worth or underlying DNA for the traits that are important to us. So I really don't need to belabor this anymore because it's so simple, but I do want to talk a bit more about this component down here, if you don't mind. But let's make sure we're on the same page as far as the performance traits first. We talked about them a minute ago, and remember they do have a genetic component, But the environment can also affect these traits. And I know every single one of you has seen examples of this as you've observed your cattle over the years. We know that for some traits, the environment plays a bigger role than for others. For example, the reproductive traits. It's really, really easy to not apply adequate nutrition and not have females breed back, right? We can do that pretty easily, can't we? Okay. Whereas some of the other traits, the environment does not affect them as much as the reproductive traits. We do have at our disposal something, though, that tells us which animals have the most genetic worth as a parent. Okay, which animals have the most genetic worth as a parent? In other words, which animals have the best genetics to pass on for specific traits to the next generation? And you all know those as EPDs, expected progeny differences. Okay, and I'm sure you're all familiar with how to use them, but I still do get asked an odd question every now and then, so I want to be sure to review what EPDs can do and what they can't. Okay, an EPD, you know, is our expected difference in future progeny of one animal compared to another. Okay, expected difference in future progeny of one animal compared to another. And you know that they're used to compare animals within a breed. Okay, I still do get questions every now and then. So if I have a bull that has a plus 1.5 for birth weight, what are his calves going to weigh? EPDs do not predict actual performance. Okay. You have to compare two animals, and it's the expected difference in the progeny of those two animals on down the road. Okay, so let's walk through an example. I'm using birth weight as my example. It is not my favorite EPD, but we'll use it as an example anyway. Bull A has a minus 1. Bull B has a plus 4. Okay, so if we were to take those two bulls, use them in the same environment, and breed them to a genetically similar group of cows, we would expect bull A's calves to average 5 pounds less than bull B's. Notice I said on average they'll be 5 pounds less than bull B's. You could get some of bull A's calves that weigh more than some of bull B's. But if you take the average, they're going to average 5 pounds less. Okay, now this question is for you. What will those calves weigh? Yeah, I'm getting some shrugged shoulders. That's good. We don't know, right? EPDs do not predict actual performance. Okay, I can't tell you that bull A's calves are going to average 70 pounds and bull B's are going to average 75. I can't tell you that. Okay, tell you there's going to be 5 pounds difference between the two. Okay, so I told you birth weight was not my favorite EPD. It's a good EPD. What's birth weight trying to tell us? Why have we selected so long and so hard on birth weight EPD? Yeah, because we want calving ease, right? Okay, and there was a time when birth weight was our best indicator of calving ease. Okay, but if we want calving ease, why don't we just select for calving ease? Okay, because weight is not the only thing that affects calving ease. And so there are a pair of EPDs, the heifer calving ease EPDs, that you all know as CED, calving ease direct, which is the EPD that you use if you're choosing bulls you're going to breed to first calf heifers. Choose this EPD when you're selecting bulls to breed to first calf heifers. Okay? It's reported in percentages. Okay? So, again, we have our bull A and our bull B, a 10 versus a 3. And so we expect 7% more unassisted calvings when those two bulls are bred to first calf heifers, bull A versus bull B. Okay, the other one, calving ease maternal, there's sometimes some confusion on. This is the EPD that you choose when you are selecting the bulls that are going to sire your replacement heifers. So you're keeping their daughters, in other words. You're picking bulls and you want to keep their daughters. This is an indication of how easy the bull's daughters will calve as heifers. Again, reported in percentages. Okay, I thought you guys might want to see this. We had an intern at AGI this summer, Heather Bradford, who is just starting her PhD at Kansas State this fall. And we had her go back and look before we had calving ease EPDs and after we had calving EPDs, what was the incidence of calving difficulty in Angus heifers? Okay, so the red bars would be before we had calving ease EPDs. Blue bars are after we had calving ease EPDs, And you all report calving ease to us on a regular basis, I know. And so you know that one would be no assistance, right? Two would be an easy pull, and three and four would be either more difficult. Okay, so you can see that we don't really have much of a calving problem in Angus heifers anyway, before or after. But you will see that after you all started using calving ease EPDs, even though we had almost 93% unassisted calvings in Angus heifers to start with, that's now at 96%. Unassisted calvings and first calf heifers.
In your examples, what is the accuracy? Are you assuming 100%?
So this, she went in and she looked at
on all your examples you were using the 7% and all that. Was that 100% accuracy sires?
Well, see, you're there's two things you're looking at. So we need to look at accuracy separate from the EPD itself, okay? Because we do know that accuracy changes over time. But if you were to use a bull with a 5, with a 10 like it was, and a 3 like it was, there would be on average a 7% difference. And so accuracy, though, tells us about something. Is their EP? How much is their EPD likely to move in the future? Is it likely to change, right? And so that's the point you're getting at. We're going to go right there. I'm glad you brought that up. We'll get there in just a second, I promise. So those are calving ease. That's interesting to know. That's a good story for Angus breeders, I think, right? You have a little ammunition now to talk about calving ease in Angus heifers and the utility of the calving ease EPDs, okay? Dollar index values, dollar values. How many of you are familiar with or use dollar values in your selection criteria some way? Yeah, a lot of folks do. A lot of folks do. There are these numbers down at the bottom. I know you probably can't see the numbers in the boxes, but you're certainly familiar with the layout up there. I know you are. They start with dollar W over here on the left and go all the way over to dollar B on the right. I'm interested as I travel throughout the country, which especially in commercial breeders, which breeders tend to use which of those indexes. So where did this concept of the indexes come from to start with, all right? Let's talk about each of your operations and your commercial customers' operations. Can we all agree that outputs, what's going out, creates revenue, whether that's weight, typically weight, whether that's the quality of the carcass, things like that. Our outputs are what create revenue. And inputs, what it costs to create those outputs, generate expense. Can everybody agree on that? Outputs create revenue and inputs generate expense. So in the past, when we had EPDs, which one of those four components did we have a selection tool for? Really that one, right? Most of our EPDs were focused on that output side, right? And we know there's three other components that contribute to profitability in the cattle business. We have to look at revenue, okay? What do we get for those outputs that are created? We know that there's cost associated with achieving these things, okay? So we need to account for those inputs and expenses, and that's where the concept of the indexes came along. It accounts for all four of those components, and then it's reported in dollars and cents, which is something that is fairly easy to interpret. So from our side at AGI, they're pretty hard to develop. They're very hard to develop. They're computationally challenging, okay? But on the good side, they're really, really easy to use. Why? Because they take multiple traits that are important at a particular phase of production. They use all of those traits and account for the revenues associated with the outputs and the expenses associated with the inputs reported in dollars and cents. So you can make directional change in multiple traits at once while looking at one number, okay? So a couple of examples. Dollar W is one that I don't think probably enough of your customers look at. I know a lot of commercial cattlemen out there who sell their calves at weaning, and for some reason they're selecting bulls on dollar B, okay? So I would submit to you, and you can help advise your customers in this regard, that dollar W might be a more valuable tool for them because it is the index that encompasses all of the revenues, expenses, outputs, and inputs associated with getting a weaned calf. Okay? So things like birth weight, weaning weight, so what those calves are gaining, what they weigh when they are weaned. We know that the milk production contributes to weaning weight in the calves. We also know there's a cost associated with those heavier milking cows, right? We know mature cow size. There's probably a tendency for a bigger cow to wean off a bigger calf, but we know that there are expenses associated with keeping a bigger cow around all year. And so all of those things are encompassed in the dollar WEPD. Probably a very valuable tool for your customers if you know they're selling their calves at weaning. Okay? The one that's probably the most famous and most people look at and I hear a lot of chatter about is dollar B. I like dollar B. I think it's a great index, but I think it's used by people a lot of times don't really need to be looking at dollar B. I think there may be some the thought that it encompasses everything from birth to carcass, and it doesn't. It is everything post-weaning. So it is the revenues and expenses, inputs and outputs associated with taking that animal through the feed yard and hanging a carcass on the rail.